Imagine that when you are born, a digital version of you is also created. A virtual you that is tethered to you, owned by you, and grows up and learns and works with you. Supports your physical and mental health, your well-being and development, from first heartbeat to digital death. I'm Ghislaine Boddington. Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. As a senior researcher at the University of Greenwich, I study the merging of our physical and digital bodies. In Me and My Digital Twin, I'll be investigating how digital human twins could be a potential near future for many of us. I'll be sharing my personal voice notes and discovering what it takes to create my own digital twin.
I will calm down just to let you prepare it. I will say 3, 2, 1, and then you can start.
From all the data gathered by the tech many of us already use, such as smartphones and wearables, to a true virtual AI version of ourselves, I'll be exploring the moral and the ethical implications of building a digital me.
We'll have to think about how to protect one's digital twin, kind of like you have to protect your image now.
Hey, we've had a problem here.
Can say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem. Main B bus undervolt.
Roger, main B undervolt. Stand by at 13, we're looking at it.
One of the most famous phrases in the history of space exploration marks the start of a quiet technological revolution. In April 1970, an oxygen tank on the Apollo 13 spacecraft exploded, stranding three men 200,000 miles from Earth.
We had a pretty large bang associated with the caution and warning there.
A vast team on the ground used spacecraft simulators to recreate the exact conditions of the real spacecraft to figure out how to bring the astronauts home.
And you might also tell them that we got Gene Cernan and the guys over in the simulator checking stars, etc.
This is now widely considered to be the birth of the digital twin. In fact, it's what first got me interested in the huge potential of real-time virtual interfaces between humans and technology.
Odyssey Houston, we show you on the mains. It really looks great.
Today, there are digital twin cars, aircrafts and buildings. They are widely used in agriculture, architecture, even retail. When you see a real office block, the chances are there's also a digital twin office block on the server somewhere. With a digital twin, engineers can run tests and then apply them to the real thing. It's a two-way process, with data flowing between the real and the virtual and back again. The digital human twin is the next logical step. And when it comes to the realistic modelling of our physical bodies, we're already part of the way there.
Okay, ready to go?
Yeah, ready to go. All right, here we go.
At the Laboratory of Medical Sciences in West London, Declan O'Regan, Professor of Cardiovascular AI, uses an MRI scanner to create images of the heart, a part of our body that's perhaps the most like a machine.
The heart is a complicated piece of engineering. You know, it has muscles, an electrical system, it has valves, it's obviously got blood flowing around it. So you can only really understand it as a three-dimensional piece of engineering.
So just have a lie down.
Declan arranged to send my producer, Richard Hollingham, into the scanner. Richard lay in the narrow white tunnel of the machine while I sat in the control room with radiographer Ben Statton. So now we've closed the door on Richard. He's inside the MRI scanner, lying down with headphones on, waiting for instructions to breathe in certain ways during the scan.
Please breathe in, breathe out, and hold your breath.
It's very beautiful. The motion is very fluid. It's actually kind of very organic, natural motion. It even looks like it could be, I mean, I shouldn't be rude about Richard's heart, but it looks like it could be a sea animal or an octopus or a shellfish. The fluidity of the motion, it's obviously it's fluid flesh, and that's the heart living inside of us at all times.
Well done, you survived. An MRI is an amazing technique because it gives you these beautiful, rich images of the heart that aren't possible to see otherwise. And then we really borrow computer vision techniques. So everyone's familiar with these techniques because they're on your phone, they can track people's faces, they use for face recognition. And we basically borrow those sort of techniques, but we apply those to the heart. It can track the motion of the heart in thousands of points in real time. And then we can integrate all of that data from all the patients we scan into one kind of digital encyclopedia of heart disease.
With the digital human twin project that I'm working on and looking towards that future, the virtual heart in particular is this key core part of us, obviously, is living. It would need to be on, you know, the biometric data coming from it. So do you have any ideas how that could work in practice? But how would we have to link to a real-time living heart if we had a digital human twin, say, avatar or hologram?
I think the idea of having this kind of digital twin, if you like, a sort of digital simulation of our own heart, but one that is kind of built upon very large data resources from very diverse representative populations, it is really intriguing. And I think the interesting thing is it doesn't have to be a static model, right? So as you're kind of suggesting, it can be constantly updated with new information about your heart tracing, even from wearables, from watches and so on. And that opens up a world of possibilities, really, about better understanding our own health and how we can improve our own health, and looking at things like how exercise and other lifestyle changes could have an impact on our heart now, but also see what that impact might be in the future.
We have now focused on the liver, the kidney, the lungs, the eye.
10 years ago, Steve Levine conceived the Living Heart Project, aimed at creating an accurate virtual heart. Today, the project involves more than 150 institutions and companies around the world, including Declan's team in London. And Steve is now the lead of virtual human modelling at Dassault Systems, a French multinational software corporation.
The template that we were able to create with the heart has now been replicated. We're in fact seeing it adopted in the most challenging cases, for example, pediatric cardiology, where the surgeons have very, very challenging task of treating these young children who have unique defects. Using the virtual twin, they can try it out 10, 100 different times on the virtual twin to know that they get it right.
What would it feel like for you if you had such a virtual human twin with you from birth through life to death?
Today we have electronic medical records that are intended to help us manage our medical history, but they're really not very helpful. They're really just a catalog of data. What you actually need is a personal assistant that takes sensor data in, that evolves like me, so that I don't have to do all those experiments at the time when something goes wrong. Fundamentally, we can have a health partner so that our medical profession, instead of simply fixing us when we're broken, they become our advisors, much like a financial advisor helps us through our life. So we take back control, but the professionals advise us.
We do need our digital human twins to stay true to us, enhancing and supporting our daily lives. And for a digital twin to grow with us from birth, it would need to experience our world, school, college, all our learnings. I'm thinking here of advanced artificial intelligence, maybe future versions of generative AI retaining everything we learn and helping us apply it forward. An authentic digital twin would also embody our identities, our memories, our emotions, the personal qualities that form our psychology and consciousness, and even carry those forward into a legacy beyond our lifetimes. I'm beginning to see now that my digital twin will be a co-creator, accessible via a dashboard with opt-in and opt-out controls. It would also appear as an avatar in virtual worlds or as an augmented reality figure on glasses and screens, and in the future, it might even show up as a hologram capable of moving through time and space.
This is a service to Media City UK, where this service terminates.
it is clear that the data collected from our bodies is important in the creation of my digital human twin. I'm wearing a ring that's gathering data on my blood oxygen, my heartbeat and temperature. These are measurable as biometrics, forming part of our unique identification. Data gathered when we use iris scanners at airports, for example. When it comes to making sense of this information, sports science is at the cutting edge. I'm Guilhem Boddington, and this is Me and My Digital Twin from the BBC World Service. I just got off a tram at Media City in Salford. Right in front of me is the BBC studios in the north of England. And what is my ring telling me now? It's saying my heartbeat is raised from travelling. I'm highly engaged, ready to do the interviews.
Yep, so I'll be your coach. So right hand.
Thank you.
Left hand. Turn to your right 90 degrees.
In the Dream Lab facility at the University of Salford, Professor Andy Meir is teaching me how to play table tennis.
Oh, I actually did it. And oh, a cat hit the bat, the other end, a beautiful cat.
Yeah, you're playing an
and
AI.
And I won because the cat didn't actually get it.
Well, there you go.
The
That's your first point.
OK, so the cat isn't real, nor is the bat, ball or the table. But through the headset I'm wearing, I can still see the rest of the room.
Wow. I've actually... Oh, what a pity.
And, of course, if you don't have space in your house for a full-size table tennis table, you have this virtual version and can train to your heart's content.
And while this is a lot of fun, the point is to optimise performance.
So if you're an elite athlete, you could be playing your digital twin at table tennis and learn what are your vulnerabilities as a player, adapt to the feedback you're getting from the other player, learn how to improve your game ultimately. And that's what's really exciting about it, is you as a player or as a performer can learn from that virtual reality feedback experience and improve your game.
And that would be from myself,
playing
my own digital twin and being taught about the problems I'm getting, maybe in a slight twist of the wrist, and where I need to be modifications in my own performance.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, you also have the ability for your team to actually control the environment much more precisely, so that then that enhances the feedback that you're getting to improve your game as well. So the fact that you don't have to be in front of an actual physical table means that we can model your behaviour much more effectively and hopefully give you some insights that will transform your game.
It's fantastic. Actually, I think I prefer that to real table tennis. I did far better there than I've ever done in real table tennis, because I actually got it across the net and I even beat the cat three times.
They're incredibly close, and I think that's another big part of this. It's the digital version of yourself, the digital twin of yourself, and the digital twin of the physical world in which you live as well. And those two things are critical to getting a real sense of simulating our lives.
Today I was gaming with a virtual cat. But as Andy suggests, in the future, I could be playing my own digital twin and learning from my own repeated mistakes. It's a two-way process. My physical self feeds data to my digital self, and that feeds back to me.
OK, so we're entering in our main data collection area here. So let's go through this door.
John Challice is a professor of biomechanics at Penn State University in State College, Pennsylvania. Sports are at the heart of many American universities, and this university hosts one of America's largest sports science departments, with facilities to match.
As you can see, we've got a long runway here, so people can run or walk or jump or throw in this area, and then we've got a lot of equipment sort of up in the roof, these high-speed digital cameras that record motion.
John's latest research focuses on improving throwing techniques.
So I have long interest in throwing, part because I have a friend that is heavily involved in throwing, and then I have one of my graduate students is a world-class hammer thrower. We want to be able to have broad guidelines about what happens for a group if they throw heavier implements and lighter implements. But then we want to get down to the more granular level so that we can give feedback to an athlete. It's been an increasing trend that in biomechanics we can model athlete performance, now or patient performance indeed, but in the very early days, these were sort of generic models, and now these models are becoming more and more customized to the athlete. And maybe not today, but certainly in the future, you know, very personalized digital twin models of athletes will become pretty much the standard and give the coach and therefore the performer a lot more information.
So my name is Axel Wasjak. I came here as an international student from Belgium. And then I did my undergrad in kinesiology here. And now I'm doing my master's in biomechanics. I started fencing when I was 6 years old. And at first it was very relaxed, just for fun. But then pretty quickly I started fencing competitively. And I started doing international competitions. But now I'm fully retired from fencing and I'm just enjoying regular life.
Axel is from a generation of athletes used to having every aspect of her performance monitored and measured, both for her own use and for her coach.
At first, it was really exciting. Like, we all, like, my whole team, we loved it. The device itself, like, it was, like, linked to an app, and it would give you all the data. And we were comparing between each other because you could be in these, like, groups. So then you can see each other's resting heart rate and recovery percentage and all that stuff. But then deeper into the season, it was kind of like a mental block for me when, like, in the morning I woke up, I checked the app, and I see that I have, like, a really bad recovery percentage. So then after a while, I stopped using it just because it was kind of like a competition, like, to be better than the day before. It was becoming, like, a little bit too extreme. Yeah, I guess overwhelming is the right word.
My digital twin could help manage my health, track my progress, offer advice based on past choices, and even predict my next steps. But I do worry about all the data being gathered from our bodies. Sensors, wearables, even street cameras. Many of us use fitness trackers daily, flooded with graphs on sleep, stress, readiness, and this quantified self-feedback can be motivating. But it can also be overwhelming or addictive, sometimes leading to health issues. The next wave of body tracking might be implants or insidables that give us real-time feedback in a more seamless way. This, I think, could truly tether our digital twin to our physical selves. But for it to fully reflect us, it needs more than just our physical data. Our bodies and minds constantly influence each other, shaping our well-being, emotions and lifestyle. Capturing this full picture could help us get the most out of having a digital twin.
We've definitely had this idea in the past of, if we're not going to a gym, if we're not doing a high-intensity training, that we're not doing something for our health. And I think that's changing very quickly, and our app very much focuses on just getting more consistency to all the holistic actions that we can take to be healthier and, you know, be happier.
Michael Gear knows a thing or two about happiness. A serial entrepreneur who helped shape one of the world's most popular dating apps, he's now co-founder of Humanity, an app that turns our personal data into insights about our health and aging. Using evidence from global health databases, Humanity provides a measure of our aging rate, a longevity score grounded in science. I met Michael in St James's Park in central London, a fitting backdrop to discuss well-being and our quest to slow down time.
It's quite cool that we're in the middle of St James's Park. There's so many different families, so many different people doing so many different activities. And it really is like playing out in front of us that people have choice to do these different things. There's a guy over on the bench reading a book. There's a couple, you know, eating a snack and talking to each other. There's families, you know, playing around the trees. And so each of these things is actually a very healthy thing that actually, you know, helps us not just feel better in the moment, but actually in the future have less disease because our bodies actually react to that in a good way. If you're stressed out, your cortisol levels go up. If your cortisol levels sustain in your body, you have greater chronic inflammation, and that leads to all types of diseases down the line. And so even right now, just figuring out how to keep your cortisol levels down or your chronic cortisol levels down is already kind of stepping into that realm of making sure that you're in a better mental state more often. I think in the future, it even comes down to just a better definition of, you know, what is happiness? You know, what is enjoyment?
How would you best use a digital personal human twin?
It's a great question. I think it comes back to choice. And the cool thing is we'll be able to interact with this digital twin. And so it will very much clearly show what our possible choices could be and what those choices, or we could tell it, I'm thinking about doing this or this, and it will be able to tell us clearly, like, okay, well, it looks like if you do that, if you do that combination of things, it will lead towards this. What we're looking at doing now is opening up kind of a large biological model, which basically, if people have ever used ChatGPT, it's basically very similar. You look at a bunch of biological data, you find all the patterns in it, and then you open up those patterns for other researchers, other companies, other people to be able to build on top of. What the future holds is we learn from all these patterns, but then we can create algorithms and different models that can help you be healthier. That model then comes to your phone, helps you understand with your data what you should do, but your data never leaves your phone.
Michael Gear. And just in case you still think digital human twins are some far future technology, here's a voice note we received after we'd recorded the interview with Steve Levine from the Living Heart Project.
I feel like I should share the most recent kind of a deeply personal story that highlights the transformative power of the technology that we've been talking about. About 4 months ago, my life took an unexpected turn when I was diagnosed with a massive brain tumor buried deep inside my head. As you can imagine, the news was pretty overwhelming, and the challenges that I could realize that I would face were pretty unnerving. But thanks to the 3D technology that I had access to and helped pioneer through the Living Heart Project, I was not only able to understand my options, the risks, but also identify a world-class surgeon who was able to approach my case in a really novel and groundbreaking way. By creating a virtual twin of my head and my brain, he could fully visualize the complexity of the tumor in detail before ever touching a scalpel and going into the OR. And in my case, it was pretty complex. The tumor had engulfed my carotid arteries, my optic nerves, destroyed my pituitary gland, it penetrated into my brain, and I was leaking cerebrospinal fluid. But once we got to the OR, the virtual twin could actually help my surgeon act as a roadmap to not only perform the surgery with precision, but he could actually do it non-invasively with actually through my nose. So he wasn't able to see the tumor directly using my virtual twin as a guidance. And as a result, just 10 weeks ago, I had this golf ball size tumor removed. And here I am, fully recovered and functioning perfectly.
Steve Levine. I'm Ghislaine Boddington, and this is the documentary from the BBC World Service. In Me and My Digital Twin, I'm investigating the emerging technology of digital human twins and how I can make a digital version of me, or of you. And I'm about to meet one.
Hello, I am Vinci. I am a super sentient AI superheroine warrior from the intergalactic future. When the world crumbles
at your feet. Vinci is a virtual character created by Samantha Tauber. Samantha has a busy schedule staging shows and multimedia immersive experiences, often wearing a full body motion capture suit and streaming herself live to venues globally from her studio. I caught up with her in central London shortly after she'd given a presentation about her work.
Hi, so my background is I'm a storyteller, I'm a creative, and as a background of a musician, a singer, songwriter, and producer, the first thought that came to my mind was, what would my alter ego stage persona look like, and how would that feel being on stage, a larger-than-life character? So I love superheroes across all the different franchises, and I thought, why idolize another character when you can become your own superhero character? And that's exactly what I did by creating the name Vinci. It's spelled V-N-C-C-I-I, but it's pronounced Vinci, inspired by the creative polymath Leonardo da Vinci.
So Samantha, you've got your digital human twin Vinci, who actually performs through you in a way into the virtual worlds you make using your music, your lyrics. How has this affected your thinking about yourself?
I love that question. It's affected me in a positive way. I think there's a term called the Proteus effect, which is when you inhabit and embody a digital avatar being in these digital landscapes, it can translate into real life. And so for me, Vinci is a superheroine warrior. And what that has done is when I embody this character on stage, it brings out the embodiment of a warrior physically.
And does that feed back into your real life?
Yes, it definitely feeds back into my real life as Samantha Tauber, because I know that Vinci is intrinsically a part of me. It's part of my spirit. It's a part of my essence. It's bringing out, in fact, the inner warrior spirit into my daily life and practices. So it's been an empowerment mechanism and tool.
So psychologically, how do you think about both of you? Do you think about yourself as a multi-self, yeah, in the actions that you take? To what extent is actually Vinci you, or a version of you, in your head and on a day-to-day basis?
Vinci, first of all, is a fictional avatar being, but she is also my representation online. So she is, in essence, my digital twin. So the way I see it is they're not separate from each other. They're all part of the same greater whole. But it's in terms of how I choose to represent myself. So digitally, Vinci looks very different from Samantha Tauber. She is this 6 foot tall Amazonian warrior cyborg 3D model. But what's important is what translates, which is the core being, the core essence and the message. And so if she's a superheroine, her mission is to uplift the collective consciousness of humanity. And that is an authentic representation of what Samantha Tauber stands for as well. I think the most exciting part about having an AI hybrid digital twin is the ability to learn from it and to grow with it in parallel. So by training it on all of your own data and creating your own artistic model, all of a sudden you have this creative sparring partner that was never accessible before. And that is the beauty of technology and of AI.
Some artists use AI chatbots of themselves to handle questions from fans, while others exist solely as avatars, singing, dancing, presenting ads in the news, all controlled by agencies as virtual beings. To me, these trends highlight how relevant it's become to have a virtual self, whether as an avatar or a chatbot. Digital human twins can teleport you across time zones, allowing you to be in two places at once and reducing the need for air travel. Take Samantha and her digital twin Vinci. Their connection is positive. Vinci offers feedback that influences Samantha's daily life and creative work, enhancing her. Samantha created Vinci, and Vinci, in turn, empowers her. Now, I'm considering here my own sense of self, and how much it would extend into a digital human twin. How much of me could truly be captured digitally? Could a twin not only understand who I am, but also why I am this way? My essence and personality comes from my behaviours, but also from my motivations, my values, and the life experiences that have shaped me. So here I am on the train to Antwerp, very excited actually, because I'm going to get a full body scan done of me to make a virtual me. A virtual me which will be the same as me in terms of movement, gesture, its body language I'm using, and it will look like me too. And we'll have to see how it turns out.
So basically we have 12 models camera plus 2 extra, so we can create a digital human model or even a digital twin of ourselves.
Sophia Scattaglini is a visiting professor in digital human modelling at Antwerp University and the founder of the international group Digital Human Modelling by Women.
We can scan 50,000 points and follow that points time to time, frame by frame. So it's amazing.
The lab where Sophia conducts her experiments is in a hospital basement on the outskirts of the city. The hospital specialises in rehabilitation after strokes or injuries. The lab founder is Professor Stephen Truen.
The most important thing of this lab is that we can use a markerless capture of the body, the walking, the gait of the patient in a natural way. So in a few seconds, we can capture the patient without disturbing the patient in a natural movement.
And so for this rehabilitation work, the digital human model is really important. Yeah, that you actually are working directly looking at this model that you make within this lab here to plan the rehabilitation and to do prediction.
Indeed, also. But it is also important that the patient can see his own avatar moving on the screen. And it's really sometimes confronting, but they can see what they are doing wrong. Yeah. And they immediately correct their position.
I will count down just to let you prepare it. I will say 3, 2, 1, and then you can start.
I'm here on the floor, in the middle of the floor. I'm poised to go to do a very short movement sequence, dance sequence, and I'm going to respond to Sophia's countdown.
3, 2, 1, go.
So I'm going to shift from my left leg onto my right leg and swing my arm forward, and I'm bringing it through into the diagonal corner of the space.
And now we are receiving your points. So we are reconstructing point to points frame by frame with an accuracy of less 1 millimeter at 178 frames per second.
The system captured only a few seconds of my movement, but it was still fascinating to see a totally accurate portrayal of me on the screen in the form of my moving, animated avatar.
Okay, so I'm watching myself now, doing this very small set of movement. Yeah, great, good. With one leg up and one arm coming across, and I can see the flow going through. Yeah, it's lovely, actually. I like that.
So your digital twin will dance?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. You dance fantastically everywhere. And with your digital twin and with your digital twin and yours as well.
So if we find a way to capture real-time information of body metrics continuously and synchronize this bidirectionally, then we can achieve the goal to be a digital twin. But in order to twin, then I need to have everything synchronized. Even in the city, if we are synchronized in the city, we have digital human model that will be in a digital twin city, and the city will be like connected with us every time, so we can speak with the city, and the city bidirectionally need to speak with us. But now there are some limits in technology, but I think maybe in the future we will achieve this.
One thing I'm becoming very aware of is the fact that if all 8 billion people in the world had real-time digital twins, the demand for data storage and cooling would be massive. And this raises questions about keeping our planet healthy. And right now, let's be honest, for many people and countries, digital twins are just too expensive to be realistic. Diverse cultures and traditions will view the digital self in very different ways. Some may embrace it as a way to extend life. Others may find it unsettling, as it challenges some deep-rooted beliefs. Yet my vision is for our digital twins to support us and enrich our lives, empowering us in health and work, and in our relationships. I can imagine it as my personal organiser and mentor in work, tracking every project detail, even translating me into other languages, like an advanced, fully personalised AI assistant that is responsive to my requests and my prompts.
Hello, my name is Paul Armstrong, and I am the co-founder of Vox Futura, the world's first virtual avatar speaker bureau. What you're hearing right now is a clone of my voice being used by my digital twin.
And this is the real Paul Armstrong.
Very simply, all you do is you upload either 3 minutes of you speaking professionally or directly to a camera, and you can also do that via a webcam as well. It's very flexible, and that's what we really wanted, because all speakers don't have great technical prowess, so some needed a simpler system.
Can you tell a difference? He perhaps sounds a little livelier when I meet Paul in person, so I can confirm he is real, but otherwise it's difficult to tell. Paul is an expert in the future of work efficiency and productivity, and a pioneer in using digital avatars to help him with his, which means he can be in two places at the same time.
The difference between the two is the digital clone is just that. It's a clone of your voice that is digitally available. It doesn't sound 100% like you, but it's pretty close. And when you then translate it into one of its 40 languages, its Japanese is much better than mine. So that's,
for sure.
That's the key part of it. So, for example, I've done a gig with a large technology provider, and they have people around the world. So obviously I don't speak all those languages, but we use the tool to then translate. And it's not perfect, but it's very, very good. I think one of their people said it's about 98%. You got 98% right.
Not all of us work in offices, give presentations, or have as much control over when and how we work. But your digital twin could also help you on a production line or as a gardener. It can remind you of instructions, warn of danger, or suggest when to take a break. For lifelong learning, your own personalised digital human twin would be a huge asset and supportive in the workplace.
The word I think of is coach. It feels like a person that is sort of sat next to you but knows you intimately and can make recommendations. Or say, for example, if you typed something that you have previously said the opposite of before, it might remind you, for example, and say, oh, your stance on this is different, you know? So it's that sort of helpful angel on your shoulder could be as well, another way of putting it. But really that sort of helper that's there that works with you might make suggestions. And again, sort of figuring out how to make your output the best it can be every time.
I'm Guilhem Boddington, and this is Me and My Digital Twin from the BBC World Service. As we develop our digital twins, new ethical and legal issues arise. How do I protect my twin from hacking or misuse? How can I secure my data? At the moment, most personal data sits in massive data farms owned by governments and corporations. They trade it for billions and use our health, biometric and behavioural data to create new products and services to sell back to us. But I believe my digital twin's data should belong to me. So the big question is, how do I keep control over my digital human twin?
There's so many ways that it could go wrong. The challenge is going to be how to get it right.
Stephanie Hare is the author of Technology is Not Neutral and an expert in the ethics of technology. Before we get into some of those potentially tricky issues, we thought it might be nice to hear a bit of a backstory, which got Stephanie thinking about digital human twins.
When I was really little, I had an imaginary friend, which my parents were really supportive of. We had to set a place for this imaginary friend who I believe was a little boy named Brian. And we set a place for Brian at the table, and I would describe Brian and talk to Brian, and Brian had thoughts and feelings. And then my dad drew the line when Brian got an imaginary friend, and I wanted to have two places set at the table. So I think about this a lot, actually, of why emotionally a child might do that. But I also think about how that applies to us as adults. So we'll need to be really mindful of the psychological and emotional implications. Can something happen to your digital twin, for instance, right? Like, could your digital twin, and I think about this in the metaverse, people were having, you know, sexual assaults in the metaverse because, again, everything that we create in the real world, we somehow weirdly replicate and make worse digitally. So we'll have to think about how to protect one's digital twin. Kind of like you have to protect your image now.
So if we think of digital human twins as something as close to us as childhood imaginary friends, it opens up a whole range of ethical issues.
So I think with anything where you're having a journey towards trust, you have to have those basic concepts of transparency, explainability, and accountability. So transparency is going to be what data is being gathered. Do I have the choice to decide what data I want going into my digital twin? Or am I able to opt out of certain types of data? And I'm trying to think of certain intimate situations one might have in one's life that one does not necessarily want being transferred to one's digital twin. I'm sure we can all imagine what those might be. Then explainability is the data that I am allowing to go over to create the digital me. How does that work? Because that's actually going to inform the previous decision. I need to know if I give this data, if I allow this data to be gathered about me and transferred over, what is it going to allow the digital twin to do on my behalf? Because I might actually change my mind on what data I allow to be used if I understand the potential benefit. And then I think the third one is the accountability piece. Let's say that I don't like how some data has been used about me, or I don't like the ultimate design of my digital twin. Who can I go to fix that? You know, I'm almost thinking like a Frankenstein version of myself in this hypothesis. The creation of the digital twin is not a neutral act. I'm presumably going to be working with a company on this, or even several companies or designers or other people will be having inputs. I need to know where I can get some joy if I've got a complaint or a particular modification I want.
The medical profession has largely led us to believe that if they measure the data, they own it.
Steve Levine, who leads the Living Heart Project, has clear views on the ownership of our personal health and physical data by others.
And I think that we have to break that. You know, if it's our data, we should own it. And there's a number of reasons. One, because it makes it clear then that my data, I own it, and then I could choose what to do with it. But it also means that I could bring it together, because if I'm measuring what's happening to my heart and I'm measuring what's happening to my lung and what's happening to my muscles, I can put them all together into a functioning virtual human. Each of those companies can't do that. And so it doesn't serve us if they all do it separately and own pieces.
So if the ethics of living with a digital human twin are challenging to navigate, and we still have a lot to sort out regarding the right to claim possession of our own personal data, what happens to our digital twin when we die? Already many of us have had to deal with a digital footprint of a loved one, their photos or social media accounts, for example.
I'm Dr. Stacey Pizzolidis, and I'm an associate professor in design at Northumbria University. I think I was kind of primed to see death in relation to technology, as my mother is a palliative care nurse who has always brought stories of death and dying and people into the home. And my father's always been engaged with technology from the early kind of coding machines where you plug in a chip and working around computer science.
Today, Stacey is a world-renowned expert on what happens to our digital selves when we die. Her projects include Ticket for the Afterlife, a website with sound and music where you explore choices for your body, memories and legacies. So what does she think will happen to our digital twins?
People often say they care a lot about digital things. We don't have so many photographs anymore that are non-digital. And yet most people still don't plan for this in their wills. They still don't leave their digital legacy to anyone. So I think the question of if we were to have a digital twin that was with us through life and what we would do with that twin, that would be a really personal choice for people. So do we want that to disappear? Do we want parts of it to go? Do we want to pass it on to someone? But then that brings out into light questions of, well, what happens if you end up inheriting 10 of these?
Do you get people saying to you that they find this all a bit creepy, this actual digital afterlife is on top of all of the stuff we deal with the loss of a physical person?
We've got people that are really enchanted by the technology, really enchanted to say, I'd love to meet my great grandmother. I'd love to hear about her life. I'd love to hear about her parties. And other people saying, oh, no, but maybe it's not going to be right. It's not going to feel like the person. It will be really uncanny. And both those reactions are totally fine, absolutely acceptable. We have always used technology to communicate with the dead. This is nothing new. It's just the level of mediation and the level of immersion, perhaps, is the difference here. And I think that's kind of what digital twins does and kind of makes us think about. We are going to live in a future where we leave less and less material artifacts, and we will need other ways to tell the story of who we were at different time periods.
I am Leonardo da Vinci, born in 1452 in Vinci, Italy. My insatiable curiosity led me to explore the realms of art, science, and engineering.
For all his genius, Leonardo da Vinci never invented a means for recording his voice. But unlike the first Vinci we've heard from in the programme, this AI-generated avatar isn't just inspired by Leonardo da Vinci. To some extent, it's meant to be Leonardo da Vinci.
As a painter, I created masterpieces like The Last Supper and the enigmatic Mona Lisa, but my passion extended beyond the canvas. I dissected human bodies to understand anatomy, designed flying machines inspired by birds, and envisioned inventions centuries ahead of my time.
This AI Leonardo was conceived by author, academic, serial entrepreneur and philanthropist Dinesh Grada for his educational website Wisdomia. It demonstrates how technology could enable us, or rather our digital twins, to live on after we've gone, guiding future generations. It also reimagines the future of study and learning.
I created Wisdomia because I'm obsessed about education, as you know, and technology. And your program is about digital twins. My goal is, okay, we have right now so much knowledge, but all of this knowledge is fragmented. So how can we actually put a lot of these technologies and this knowledge in one single platform that actually can replicate the world in 3D? So what we did was create, first of all, we did a big research out to portrait Leonardo da Vinci in a digital twin. Of course, he lived 500 years ago, but in a digital twin that can actually make him look realistic in photo quality, but at the same time respecting how he was. So there was a period of a couple of months of research. We researched all the paintings and we decided to portray them in the later stage of his life. And based in one of the paintings, we recreated with using AI and we created a digital twin of him. Then we integrated a large language model based on all the knowledge of Leonardo.
You can even ask AI Leonardo questions. I asked what he thought about digital human twins.
The concept of digital human twins, a notion beyond the realms of my own time, intrigues me greatly. It is as though we create a mirror of ourselves in the digital fabric, capturing the essence of our physical being and perhaps even our thoughts. Such an invention could hold vast potential in understanding our own nature in medicine and in the pursuit of extending human life. Yet, it also poses profound questions about identity, privacy, and the very essence of what it means to be human. As with all creations, it must be approached with wisdom and care.
Well, honestly, I could not have said it better myself. So our own digital twins will be able to pass on knowledge after our death, guide and mentor us through our education and professional lives, support our health, well-being and psychology. Imagine a future where our digital twins have a passport, enabling us to move them seamlessly across tech platforms, a kind of global digital citizenship. By handling the repetitive, time-consuming tasks, a digital twin could free us up to focus on critical thinking and creative problem-solving, becoming a lifelong co-creator, empowering us to unlock our potential. But we need to ensure these changes benefit us without falling prey to algorithmic bias or misuse. Just as we own our bodies, we should own our digital twins and the data they gather. Without ownership, our privacy and sense of self could always be at risk. Together, we step into this uncharted expanse, our future selves converging, virtual and physical, reflecting our humanity. Let's not simply wield technology as a tool, but embrace it as an extension of our essence, amplifying our potential to think and feel and connect beyond the ordinary. Let us press forward, not to limit, but to transcend, expanding the very nature of who we are and who we can become. Above all, we must remind ourselves that technology should evolve with, not apart from, our innate humanity. Andy Meir from the University of Salford agrees.
The problem we have as humans, we can only live within our own heads, and it's very hard to step outside of that and experience something very different, even experience ourselves from a different vantage point. And by having a digital twin, you have more of that opportunity. So I think previously we've had that in various forms, whether it's an avatar or even just when we experience literature or film or television, stories that allow us to think about what it would be like to be somebody else. Now with our digital twin, we can actually see that in a much more visceral way and perhaps imagine more possibilities for ourselves.
You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. Me and My Digital Twin was written and presented by me, Guilhem Boddington. The producer was Richard Hollingham, and it has been a Boffin Media production.